Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here. And more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Why study history? It's a simple question without a simple answer. One college professor says that most historians would fail tests that we routinely give to high schoolers, and that encouraging students to raise questions can be more instructive than having them breeze through another multiple choice exam. A 1917 study found that students recall less than half the history facts their teachers said they should know. A 1944 study found a similar problem. Fact-based knowledge is fleeting. So, is it time to get American students off the testing bandwagon? What is the common history that all Americans knowingly share? And how should history be taught to make it matter? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Seattle, Washington, is Sam Weinberg, professor of educational psychiatry and an adjunct professor of history at the University of Washington. He's the author of Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts, Charting the Future of Teaching the Past. Good evening and welcome, Sam Weinberg.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. We're also joined tonight from the studios of Vermont Public Radio by our own On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Sam Weinberg, take us into this. And the last several months have made everybody especially attuned to the importance of history. People want to know what's going on in the world, why things happen the way they happen. And after 9/11 shook America up, there was then concern about Americans' grasp on their own history and the civil liberties and constitutional guarantees and political and philosophical breakthroughs that America represented. How do you see the importance of history in times of change and challenge?
Well, I think the importance of history is absolutely central in our understanding what's going on in the world. The problem is that it too easily becomes a question of the right slogans that we want young people to mouth. And we create a kind of nostalgic longing for a history that actually never was. The belief that there was one time where American school children actually knew the kinds of things that teachers said that they should know. And as you began at the top of the program, when we go back into the past and check these historical claims, it looks quite different from what many people claim to be the case.
You mean that there was a time when you could ask Susie or Jose or Johnny the names of all the presidents and the dates of all the wars and the Bill of Rights, and they'd have them all at their tip of their tongue?
Exactly. So the test that you referred to from 1917 was administered in 1915 to 1916 in Texas to high school students and college students. Now, just think for a second, the kind of young people that were attending high school, less than 10% of the population in the elite in 1915 and 1916. And the authors of that particular study, J. Carlton Bell and D.P. McCollum, concluded that students knew less than a third, actually, of the most basic and obvious facts of American history. So it seems to be a kind of necessary ritual that we do in every single generation, which is to wring our hands and say, ah, today's young people are unrooted in the past, and this is this will betoken a cultural disintegration. But when we actually go back and look into the past, we see that this is almost a very necessary ritual that adults have to engage in.
That is the ritual of concern for a potentially lost past.
It is exactly a concern for a lost past that we never really possessed in the first place.
Richard Rothstein wrote of your book in the New York Times, and he said, if civic unity really depended on a facts-first approach, this nation would not have survived. And you seem to be seconding that idea or perhaps originating that idea. So even so, you write about history because it's important. I guess two questions come to mind. First of all, if it's not the facts, what is it about history that's important? And what can we take from history that's meaningful if there isn't some factual underpinning?
Well, let me possibly correct a misunderstanding. I think that factual knowledge is absolutely central to historical understanding. Absolutely central to have a sense of chronology and to have sets of core knowledge that help us navigate the various information that is bombarded at us on a daily basis. But if you were to pick up the average high school textbook, either the one that you probably picked up in high school, Tom, mm-hmm. or the one that you had, Jack, or the ones that we can find on today's bookshelves that are given to today's 17 and 18 and 16-year-olds, there is absolutely no way that an educated person could go through life mastering that amount of material unless that person dedicated their life only to knowing that body of work. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the chapter review tests that are given in the typical American history textbook, as I've shown, when we give these questions to practicing historians, in other words, to people who have a proclivity for knowing and remembering and understanding the past, the kind of the density of factual information that we demand of young people is something that is not even possessed by those people who call themselves professional historians when they are not working in that topic area. So
you're not for an enormous supermarket full of facts at the tips of everyone's fingers, but you'd say a factual awareness or access to the facts when you need them is important. You go on, though, and you talk about a kind of thinking, historical thinking, and counterintuitively for someone writing about the importance of history, at least to me, you say that historical thinking in its deepest forms is neither a natural process nor something that springs automatically from psychological development, as the title of your book says, that historical thinking is an unnatural act. What do you mean by that?
Well, let me try to explain it by way of an example. My craft is I'm a psychologist by training, and I try to understand the process and nature of psychological development in young people. And in one of the studies that I did, I gave a series of documents to a group of very bright high school students who, in fact, possessed copious amounts of factual knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I had these young people look at a series of documents about the Battle of Lexington, which is quite pertinent for your part of the country. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that this young person could not understand was the colonists' own account that they stood in the face of a much more overwhelming force of British troops, and they did not retreat. And it was absolutely incomprehensible to this young person that people would not shirk away from Lexington Green and hide behind walls and start to act like what we do when we're faced by a much more overwhelming enemy. We engage in guerrilla warfare.
So how does that response then begin to illuminate what you call historical thinking?
Well, this is precisely the kind of challenge in front of this young person. What we typically do when we look at the past is we use our own present-day conceptual apparatus and think that it is sufficient for understanding people who are very different from us and who lived in a very different time. And I don't think that it's something that automatically comes as a process of development to say, wait a second, particularly when we're reading written documents and people use language that seems to us to be perfectly understandable language. For us to stop and say, wait a second, I know what these words mean to me, but what possibly could they have meant to Abraham Lincoln writing to a group of freed slaves about the possibility of establishing a colony in Central America in 1863? That's not quite something that typically comes just as part of development. It's something that is taught, it's trained, it's the kind of thing that we need to gauge for and we need to aim for because it's so absolutely central in understanding our social world.
Jack Beattie, Sam Weinberg is saying we've got to go beyond facts and make a kind of intuitive or empathetic leap into understanding history. You see that need?
I do, and I think September 11th confronted us with it. That what I find valuable in his essays is the emphasis on history as a humanistic discipline. That is to say, something like literature, One of the reasons people read literature is to experience otherness, people who aren't themselves and yet who have very much a lot like themselves. You know, the balance between idiosyncrasy and universality. That same thing is true in history. And the faculty of historical empathy, which I really think is what historical thinking is a way of actually enriching ourselves by getting beyond our prejudices, at the same time using them to know another, to know a whole different world. And that exercise, quite apart from any civic upshot it may have, and I think it has a considerable one, is itself valuable. It's just an imaginative process that enriches us. And I think it's insufficiently emphasized in school to the detriment, really, of our personal development.
But the political debate, Sam Weinberg, has been about this basic body of knowledge, let's say, of American history. And many people have argued, and you referred to this at the top of our conversation, that without that basic understanding of fundamental elements of American history, we can't have a shared understanding of the American past. We can't have a shared understanding of the sacrifices and the political breakthroughs that America represents. Is historical empathy a substitute for knowing the basic facts of history, or is that a red herring?
Tom, I think it's a red herring. First of all, there's a prior question to ask, which is, do we lack a shared basis of knowledge that allows us to communicate across our differences in this country? And I'm not sure that I'm willing to sign on to that assumption. You see, there is a predetermined conclusion of all of the kinds of standardized tests that we give to young people. Try to engage in this thought experiment for a second. Try to imagine the headlines in the Boston Globe tomorrow morning. New test on American history determines that young people know far more than we ever anticipated. First of all, it would never be a headline. But even beyond that, the way the tests are constructed is in a way that the kinds of items on these multiple choice tests that most young people do know are eliminated from the test so that they never could possibly come to that result that would lead to a headline that would proclaim a shared body of knowledge.
But you said something interesting to me. You said you're not sure that there is a shared body of information that Americans ought to commonly know. What do you mean?
No, I said quite the opposite.
Okay.
I said I do believe that there is a shared
okay.
body of knowledge.
Okay.
I'm not, as a psychologist, I'm not quite the one to, I think I can contribute to the debate. And I think that what I offer in this debate is I do empirical work. I try to check out some of the assumptions that are floating around in the air and try to see if they, when they're put to the test, if they actually hold up. So in some of my latest work, I have been working about with what it is that young people know about Vietnam. And in many respects, at least from the small, fairly representative sample that I've been working with in a longitudinal study for the past several years, most young people, whether it comes from school or comes from the media or if it comes from the larger cultural context, have a basic narrative of certain things about the Vietnam era. There are certain things that they don't know, but certain things that they do know. And I think that we too often assume that that culture and schools are doing a poor job in creating a shared historical context for young people. And I guess I'm skeptical about that claim.
So you're saying that even if they can't cite chapter and verse of date and location of a particular battle or a particular presidency, American young people are somehow soaking up an understanding of the country's history?
I think that it's fair to say that, and I think that it's an interesting empirical question to investigate. The sociologist Michael Schutzen says that historical knowledge is something far beyond what it is that 17-year-olds are able to respond to on a test, that historical knowledge seeps in through our cultural pores.
Jack Beatty, we would like to believe that, Jack, but at the same time, I get nervous when people don't know some basic things. As Sam says, it always shows up in the headlines.
It does show up in the headlines. But, you know, if people have come to that common, they have a hurdle to get over, and that is the textbooks. A decade ago, I was commissioned by Columbia University to study 12 textbooks in use in colleges and in secondary schools. And I must say that if that's what young people people have to go on to get to the common knowledge. The literary task before them is just Herculean.
Of just chipping their way through those textbooks.
Glaciers of text.
There's sympathy for the history student here tonight, and also a broader conversation about the role that history plays in the United States, in the world, in understanding what we're all in the middle of. You can join the conversation. How are your children learning history? Are they learning to think historically or just to memorize? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American, about world history, and about the roles of each of us as historians, the importance of us individually and collectively knowing, sharing, and empathizing with the lessons of history. How are your children learning history? Are they learning to think historically or just to memorize? And what do you hope for when you dig into a David McCullough's, John Adams, or a Stephen Ambrose history? Americans do it in large numbers. What are you looking for there? What do we share there? We're talking tonight with Sam Weinberg. He's professor of educational psychiatry and an adjunct professor of history at the University of Washington. He's author of the book Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jerry is on the line. Welcome, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I agree with part of what you're saying. I disagree with some other things. I'm an eighth grade American history teacher.
Great.
And the one thing I guess I would disagree with first is one of your guests said that referring to history as literature, that we're there to learn about the other. And I think, in fact, the key to learning history is not that we're studying about the other, about people in the past, but that we study history to learn about ourselves, to figure out who we are, where we've come from, and who we are and what we're going to become.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also disagree that I'm not sure they're, and I'm, of course, flying in the face of everything that I was trained to or my department head would want me to say, but that I don't know that we need a core set of knowledge. I think there needs to be a set of skills, how to find the knowledge, how to do the research, how to take that information and apply it to solve a problem, figure something out.
But Jerry, let me dig in on that. You're an eighth grade history teacher, yeah, and you're dubious about the idea of a core curriculum. Do you mean that literally? No core understanding of history that American young people would come out of elementary school understanding?
I'm not going to paint that black and white picture and absolutely throw it all out. But I think that I agree with, you know, multiple choice testing, you know, the MCAS type thing is a problem. And it turns out, I've only been teaching a couple years, but it turns out kids that year after year seem to be getting more and more concrete and less able to be abstract and think abstractly and take the knowledge and apply it to a different level.
Hmm.
So I end up turning around and producing kids who might do well on Jeopardy, but are not going to be able to take that knowledge and do anything with it. And
Jerry, stand by. Let me put this to Professor Sam Weinberg. Sam Weinberg, there's several points here that speak directly to the kinds of things you write about, but I guess from Jerry's first point is he's thinking history is not about understanding the other. It's about understanding ourselves. Is there really a dichotomy there?
I don't think so. I think they're very much united. And I think that in looking at the other and trying to understand people different from ourselves, we understand our own proclivities, we understand our own biases and our own assumptions much deeper. And so I see them as processes in tandem.
And Jerry also is concerned that he sees young people less able to abstract, to pull concepts up out of history. Good for Jeopardy, not so good for your notion of historical empathy.
Again, I think we need to separate out the question of the effects of instruction and the capabilities of young people. And so if we're saying that if we're in a particular era where a particular kind of instruction of rote memorization of facts that don't have meaning for the kids and the only endpoint is a performance on a test, then I think that, of course, if this is the fare that young people are given, this is the kind of reaction that they'll have.
Mm-hmm.
I get very, very cautious about statements about the kind of developmental capacities of young people mm-hmm. to engage in abstract thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with a group of fifth and sixth graders now with a group of historical documents, and they are deeply abstract and able to sustain very sophisticated historical arguments.
Let's turn to a student. Jared is on the line. Welcome, Jared. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I'm
a senior at Wayland High School, which is a suburb of Boston. And
great. Good to have you, Jared.
Thanks. Over the past 4 years at this small high school, I've been subject to many different kinds of history teachers.
Subject to these teachers.
Yeah.
Sounds like a torture.
And I'd just like to say that I don't think that it's a good idea to just throw facts out at students. I think it's much more important to have open debates in class and open floor discussions rather than just you learn the facts and you get tested on them. I think it's...
Have you been taught history both ways, Jared?
Yes, I have. I took a class called College World Cultures in which the teacher just simply threw out facts at us and we were tested on them. And just I don't recall much from that class. And in the past 2 years, I've taken American history and a social sciences class. The first semester was Media and the American Democracy, and this semester is The World Since 45, and they've just been more open discussion classes. Maybe it's something with maturity, but I've just gotten a lot more out of them.
And do they leave you with an abiding interest in history, Jared?
Definitely. Heading to Washington, D.C. next year, and I mean, it's definitely sparked a huge interest in politics and law for me. And my teachers have been had a huge role in that, definitely.
Jared, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, here's a student who, when he's given the chance to debate and discuss, is ready to step right into history.
Sure, and lots of kids are. You know, this emphasis on facts, it just doesn't work. Here are some sentences culled from the work of American and Canadian college students in a recent book called Non-Campus Mentis. Sentence one, Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous "If I Had a Hammer" speech. Sentence two, John F. Kennedy worked closely with the Russians to solve the Canadian Missile Crisis. Ferdinand and Isabella conquered Granola, a part of Spain now known as Mexico. Florence Nightingale was a knight. Adam Smith was an American president, on and on and on. If the end of this is to teach facts, the facts aren't being retained. They're being combined in these sort of Dada-esque formulations, and it ain't sticking. And the emphasis, as I think Jared was making on the MCAS test and the state requirements and so on, it's again we're prisoners of our metrics. What we can measure is the multiple choice, mm-hmm. but that's not necessarily the gift that we want to inculcate. That's not the but it's what we can measure, so we test to it. And mm-hmm. it I'm afraid it's going to reinforce more and more of sentences like Stalin, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Truman were known as the big three.
Well, Sam Weinberg, what about that? We, as you've noted, there's something in the country's character, maybe every country's character, where we want to flay ourselves with the kind of absurd parroting and misparroting that Jack's just citing here. Why do we want to? Why are we so ready to want to beat ourselves up over this factual inadequacy? And how do we get students who are beyond that?
Well, it's so curious that Jack brought up these examples, Tom, because there was a study in 1922 by someone named Gary C. Myers at the Brooklyn Training School, and he did a similar kind of thing. He gave students identification questions. And so, for instance, he gave them the question of to identify the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, and they confused him with William Henry Harrison. Or Cyrus McCormick, the inventor of the Reaper, was confused with, at that point, a popular singer named John McCormick.
And Americans were duly outraged and depressed about it 90 years ago.
Exactly. Now, what's common in both of these is a kind of folk theory of mind, I would say, a kind of way that we explain to ourselves how we think the mind works. And I think that the default metaphor that's used here is the mind is a kind of old attic, where we store a bunch of tools or pieces of information that we don't necessarily have any need for, and that when the time comes, we'll go down in that, or we'll go up into that attic and we'll dust off the tool and we'll be able to take it down from the shelf and it'll be serviceable. Mm-hmm. And I think that what's the constant here across the ages is such a fundamentally flawed notion of the way that people actually learn and engage in deep and meaningful learning.
You write about it as though you want to see people engaged as if it were with their own contemporary literary community, their own contemporary circle of friends and world somehow. Jennifer's on the line. Welcome, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I teach college. I'm a college professor at Gordon College in Wenham. And it's a real goal that I have for my students that they learn to think historically in the manner that has been discussed. And I think it's important from Western Civ that many freshmen take, students who aren't going to be history majors. I want all the way through senior students, I want them to learn to use historical imagination to understand other people and to think historically.
What does thinking historically mean to you, Jennifer? Is it imagining the circumstances that existed in another time?
Yeah, and to be able to step outside themselves and into someone else's shoes. I emphasize the use of primary sources in my class, which are sources written by people in different periods. And your guest has talked about how difficult those can be to understand. And so I think students need to be given tools to understand them. And I had an experience last fall that really brought this home to me.
Tell us.
In the aftermath of September 11th, I had a student who was an internship in New York who witnessed the collapse of the towers and wrote me a letter describing her experience. And the next day, I went into class, and of course, all the students, as we all across America, are having trouble dealing with this crisis. And I read for them my student's letter describing the events and her own emotional reaction to the events. And I said to them, this is a primary source. You've read primary sources from ancient Egypt, from ancient Greece, from the Middle Ages. This is a primary source, and a peer of yours wrote it, a student from Gordon College. And
did they make the connection? Did it somehow bring to life the Egyptian primary source once they had instant history?
Yes, and I said, now when you read about the plague at Athens that Thucydides describes, now you know a little bit better what that chaos and pain and trauma feels like because we've gone through it today and because you've heard about it from a primary source that's just one of you. And to get that through their heads that primary sources are just sources written by ordinary people, not historians.
It's a great example, Jennifer, and thank you for sharing it with us. Sam Weinberg, it sounds like Jennifer is singing your song here. She's eliciting historical empathy from her students, in this case, on September 12th.
Exactly. I can very much empathize and support what Jennifer was saying about the use of primary sources. A study I did about 14 years ago, I gave students a series of primary source documents where and I also included some textbook accounts. And the textbook was at odds with both sides that were represented in the primary source documents. And much to my vexation and chagrin, these very able high school students, 16 and 17-year-old, very good readers, our best students, when they were asked to formulate a historical interpretation, what they relied upon was the final word of the textbook.
Because the textbook had boiled it down for them? They didn't have to do the hard work of making their own analysis?
Well, I don't
because
want to,
it was an authority figure of sorts.
I think that the irony here is that the textbook had become the primary source.
Well, it's easy to see how that would happen. It's easier to accept the distillation that's already been done, right or wrong, perhaps, than to make one's own distillation. Jack Beatty, don't you think so?
Yeah, and it's written in a omniscient tone, a tone of, you know, from the mountaintop, and hedges and qualifications. Professor Weinberg, you know, cites them like may or might or appears or perhaps or could have been. All that is washed away, and instead we get this sort of adamantine reflection. This happened and that happened, and there's no room for the person. Oh well, okay. In the face of, I think it was Kierkegaard who said, in the face of the truth, how can I be myself? People feel that in the face of these monolithic texts that just come down as if the Sermon from the Mount.
Sam Weinberg is saying if you do the work of breaking through, though, to the primary source, then you're actually achieving what history has to offer. Kathy's on the line. Welcome, Kathy. You're on the air.
Oh, I love the show.
Thanks.
And I particularly enjoyed the Irish writers.
Wasn't that good? Yeah, that was fun.
I actually got on the show, but I love what Jack and you said about, you know, lack of empathy for, you know, historical figures. I was originally trained as a psychotherapist at University of Michigan, and then my interest in living too much in the moment as an interest, you know, and short-term memory loss that we all confront every day sort of led me to my study of John Adams. And
who now everyone's reading about with David McCullough's book.
Listen, I found him before he was hot on the bestseller.
Okay, you were ahead of the curve.
I stumbled upon his diaries at Harvard Library.
So what have you taken out of this? What have you taken away on the history front?
What I found about John Adams, I think it's reflective of this conversation, is that he did not neatly fit on an 8.5, 11 page or any textbook. He did not never tell a lie. He didn't chop down a cherry tree. John Adams is a guide for kids, daydreamers, adult daydreamers, the American dream. He possessed the American dream gene, and he is a complex figure that I have loved and still love, and I just wrote a brief book about him that helps people connect the dots of their experience through time in their own life, connect the dots of your experience through time in your own life, and using John Adams.
Through John Adams. Kathy, thanks so much for your call and observation. Sam Weinberg, Kathy's raised up John Adams, and of course a lot of people have been reading about him in David McCullough's book. Kathy raises the issue of complexity around figures. What do you make of the American love affair with these big popular works of history by McCullough and others? Do they adequately contain that complexity, or is this the textbook phenomena writ large, where there's a simplification that goes on that makes things familiar and comfortable?
Well, I think that any time we look at a single authored piece of history, there are going to be simplifications, and we are receiving a particular interpretation as filtered through the foibles and flaws and dispositions of a particular mind. But these are opportunities. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about engaging with history as a humanistic discipline, whether even before Ambrose was taking some fire for the latest things in the news, there are certain things, particularly in the book Undaunted Courage, where he was roundly criticized.
This is the Lewis and Clark book.
The Lewis and Clark book, for getting in the book with Lewis, getting in the keelboat with Lewis, and being impervious to, for instance, Lewis and Clark arriving at certain places with indigenous peoples and being offered as gifts their wives. And where is Ambrose as a narrator in this book? And in that sense, of course, I mean, any historical work, any fruit that is of human hand is going to be problematic and flawed. But these are wonderful opportunities for engaging with these questions in a critical way, in ways that help us become more thoughtful about any kind of interpretation that we receive, whether it's over the airways or whether it's in print form.
Jack Beatty, the popularity of David McCullough's books and others would seem to belie the notion that Americans don't care about history.
Yes. I mean, they sit astride the bestseller list year after year. I guess my thought about that is that in some ways, I haven't read John Adams, but Truman, which I loved a lot. I mean, an epic book. But, you know, it was kind of a Valentine to Harry Truman. And that's fine, but that's an old kind of history. You know, Parson Weems did that with Washington. And I'm just not sure that that alone gets the sufficient complexity that our caller just mentioned. Kathy was just mentioning that sometimes these popular biographies just really talk about these people as if they're heroes rather than as if they're human beings.
Well, our guest tonight, Sam Weinberg, says plunge in all the way in so deep into history that you empathize through first-person accounts, and if you can, go beyond the textbook. What do you think? Why teach history, and what should our children be armed with? More names, more dates, more facts, or historical empathy? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about history, the importance of history, and the best way to real historical understanding. Our guest tonight, Sam Weinberg, is author of Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts. He reminds us in a quote that from the Roman Cicero, that not to know what happened before one was born is always to be a child. What do you make of Americans' understanding of history today? Why teach history? And do Americans know more history than we think? Do Americans know the important, the essential, the honest gist of history, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Siddiqui is on the line. Welcome, Siddiqui. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening.
Hi.
Yeah. What I was calling for, you know, I've been listening to the conversation, but one aspect that was very disturbing to me is the fact that I hear the emphasis on retention but not reform. And what I'm referring to is, in many respects, history as it's been taught in this country, you know, has been one big lie, and in many respects, racist. And, you know, for instance, the Greek philosophers, you know, all the information that they had, they stole when they attended African universities. Cleopatra did not look like Liz Taylor. George Washington couldn't tell a lie, but he had over 350 slaves. I heard the mention of Abe Lincoln discussing with freed slaves the possibility of going to Central America to mm-hmm. form their own state, when mm-hmm. the reality is that Abe Lincoln, who did not free the slaves, in fact, was deferred to the slaves at the Negro problem, and a possible program to send all the former slaves back to Africa, and so on and so on. So what's disturbing for me is that, you know, do we continue to perpetuate this lie in terms of retention of facts, or do we in fact say, look, it's time to give this a new look and look at some reform? You know, I feel, you know, I'm a former school teacher, and you mm-hmm. have black students who they hear about slavery, but they're not told about, well, where did these slaves come from? Mm-hmm. The most sophisticated societies in the world at the time. And that type of background, it's not there.
It's not there in your... Siddiqui, you raise a couple of great points. And let me put it first to you, Sam Weinberg. I guess Siddiqui says, well, the fundamental American approach to history is off, or in his words, a lie. Take that on. And then if you would, take on Abe Lincoln in particular, because he was a great figure in American history with a great range of statements in his life on blacks and slavery. So where is the American center of gravity? How near is it to accuracy in your assessment in the understanding of history? And help us, maybe through the Abe Lincoln example, understand how we get to wherever we are.
Well, I would classify the kind of view that Siddiqui is putting forth here as one that is pretty much the nature of the debate that's gone on in this country for about the past 10, 15 years about the history curriculum. It's been a very rancorous debate about which history to teach in our schools, whether to teach the particular history that, I mean, and it's in a very kind of clean-cut form that Siddiqui was talking about as the conventional history, as in his words, been a lie. Versus the notion of a kind of celebratory history that, in fact, Jack referred to when he was talking a little bit about the Valentine biographies that often make it to mm-hmm. the bestseller list. Mm-hmm. I think that, Tom, is a red herring. I think that there's a prior question, which is to ask, why should we teach history? And you began the program with invoking September 11th. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that we can be proud of, and one of the things that I think we need to get back to, is the kinds of ways, for instance, that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson talked about the role of history in the curriculum as a way of teaching us to deal with contending voices, with the cacophony of voices in a marketplace that are all after our own opinion and vote. And Siddiqui is representing one of those voices. He makes some historical claims that all of Western philosophy was pilfered from African universities. That's a historical claim. What's the evidence for that? How would we adjudicate, rather than simply taking his belief on face value? What are the kinds of ways of thinking that young people, in fact, the general public, could evaluate that claim and evaluate it thoughtfully about looking at the relationship between claims and evidence?
That's what you want, I guess, is a population capable of diving in and really sorting that out. How close are we to having that population, Sam?
Well, I think, Tom, it's if we look at the way that history is taught in some of our finest universities, I think we will find in many instances that is the nature of discussion in our best history seminars. I think the question is are we willing as a nation to extend those kinds of opportunities for developing that kind of thought to all students?
That must be where richness lies. Sam Weinberg, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Sam Weinberg is professor of educational psychiatry and adjunct professor of history at the University of Washington. His new book is Historical Thinking and Other Unnatural Acts, Charting the Future of Teaching the Past. And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our website, onpointradio.org. With Hollywood's biggest night now less than a week away, actors, actresses, directors, producers, musicians, and set designers are all starting to cross their fingers and say an extra prayer that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences will vote them the best of 2001. Each night this week, we're looking at the actors, actresses, and films nominated for this year's top prizes. We begin tonight with nominees for Best Actress. This year's entrants consist of one past winner, one past nominee, and three category rookies, all fighting for an honor shared by Hollywood greats like Katharine Hepburn, Sally Field, and Elizabeth Taylor. We're joined by our on-point movie maven, Garen Daly, to size up this year's group. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
We're great, thanks. Garen, what does the crop of actresses look like this year? What's the vetting here?
This is a really wide-open year. I haven't seen a year where so many people really don't know what's going on with who's going to win and who's not going to win. So it's pretty wide open, and I think it's going to be very exciting.
Let's go through actress by actress, movie by movie. Where do you want to begin?
Let's start with who I think is probably the least likely to win, and that's Renee Zellweger, which is not to say that her performance is bad at all. Just the opposite. She does a really nice job in a film called Bridget Jones' Diary.
That seems like years ago I saw that film.
Well, in terms of movies, it was years ago. It was like early summer when it came out. She does a great job. Here's an American actress playing an English working girl who is working and trying to figure out what the meaning of life is. She's single. She's having problems. She needs to make some resolutions.
I decided to take control of my life and start a diary to tell the truth about Bridget Jones. The whole truth. Resolution number one.
Ooh.
Obviously, we'll lose 20 pounds. Number two. Always put last night's panties in the laundry basket. Equally important, we'll find nice, sensible boyfriend to go out with and not continue to form romantic attachments to any of the following. Alcoholics, workaholics, commitment phobics, peeping toms, megalomaniacs, or perverts. And especially we'll not fantasize about a particular person who embodies all these things.
Renee Zellweger there with the famous 20 pounds, the famous candor, really inside her personal diary.
And that's what makes this so accessible. She's very vulnerable. She's very sweet. Just about every woman I've ever talked to loves her in this film. And it's that vulnerability that really, really worked for her. And, you know, you see that vulnerability in a couple of other nominees, specifically Judi Dench, who has won Oscars before and has been up for a ton of Oscars before. It's almost like it's not Oscar season unless Judi Dench has got at least one.
The very grand Judi Dench.
The grand dame. But she's up for Iris, where she plays Iris Murdoch. And in the film, it is a dual film where on one side she's a young girl played by Kate Winslet, and then it's her when she's older and she's suffering from Alzheimer's. And it's a story between her and her husband, and it's her slow decline into dementia.
Very touching story.
Education doesn't make you happy. And nor does freedom. We don't become happy just because we're free, if we are, or because we've been educated, if we have. But because education may be the means by which we realize we are happy. It opens our eyes, our ears, tells us where delights are lurking, convinces us that there is only one freedom of any importance whatsoever, that of the mind.
Judi Dench in Iris, is this homage to Alzheimer's, to the tenderness of a marriage, to Judi Dench and just needing to have her in the lineup for grandeur?
Well, I think, obviously, having Judi Dench in any lineup makes things really wonderful because she is such a great actress and she brings such gravity to this film. But this is a very somber film about what it's like for a person to lose their mind, and that clip that we heard presages what happens to her. It's very touching and kind of disturbing when you see the film.
Very human. Halle Berry in Monster's Ball. Things get very human.
It's an incredible performance that she puts on this film. She plays a young woman whose husband is executed for murder. And as you move through the film, she ends up dating and falling in love with not only one of her executioners of her husband, but also a white guy. And there is some people feeling a little uncomfortable about this, but her performance is so tender, so, again, vulnerable, just like Renee Zellweger, but in a human level that is not reached in
Bridget Jones.
Bridget Jones, yes. But Monster's Ball is a very good film, and she's very good, and she may be the first black woman ever to win a Best Actress award.
I can't take this.
As my son, it'd mean a lot to him. I'm sure he'd want it that way. He'd want somebody to have it to get some use out of it.
Well, I ain't saying I don't want it. I just can't take it.
I want you to have it. I really do. It'd mean a lot to me. Let's just take it for a little spin.
I ain't even got my shoes on.
That's all right. We won't go far. Let's go. Come on. Let's see how it drives.
A breakthrough role for Halle Berry, not just another pretty face.
Absolutely. And you know what's really interesting about this is that she was only paid $100,000 for this role. Only $100,000. When you think about it, Will Smith, who is up for Best Actor, another black actor, got paid $20 million. So she scaled back just to play this role to prove to everyone what a good actress she is, and she does a great job. She won the Screen Actors Guild Award for Best Actress, and she's one of the leading candidates to win this year.
Nicole Kidman, big, lavish film, Moulin Rouge.
Moulin Rouge, everyone keeps talking about how Baz Luhrmann, this Australian director, has reinvented the musical, and he's brought Nicole Kidman along. But let's be honest about it. When Nicole Kidman married Tom Cruise, we were all saying she's going for the ride. She's like trying to, it's a career move for her. But she has proven, at least to me, that she is a good actress and a real trooper. She played a number of the scenes in this film where she is hurt and in a wheelchair and you don't see it. In the film, she plays a consumptive, romantically inclined courtesan at the famous Moulin Rouge. She falls in love with a poet, and then all of a sudden, there's a duke who wants to take her away. She realizes that she's dying. She wants to save the poet from any possible harm, so she goes out of her way to convince him that she doesn't love him anymore.
The Moulin Rouge is my home.
No. There must be something else. This can't be real. There's something the matter. Tell me what it is. Tell me what's wrong. Tell me the truth. Tell me the truth.
The truth is, I am the Hindu courtesan, and I choose the Maharaja. That's how the story really ends.
All the lavish passion in the world, is this the kind of vehicle that makes Best Actress Award winners?
You know, she's running hot in a lot of surveys right now, but I'm not sure that she's going to be the winner. I really don't. I think that our next candidate might be the one that is going to go for it, and that's Sissy Spacek in The Bedroom. Again, a wonderfully small, nuanced film where she plays a middle-class teacher in a small New England town whose son is having an affair with an older woman, and it's going to come to tragedy, and she has to deal with it.
It's been a long time since we heard a big splash from Sissy Spacek.
She's actually been out of the limelight for about 10 years, but she was on a roll there. She did Coal Miner's Daughter, which she won an Oscar for. Mm-hmm. She was nominated for Badlands, Three Women, Straight Story. She did a lot of great films. In this film, again, she and her husband have this son, and he's going out with a woman, and she has an abusive husband.
Are you going to press charges?
No.
Well, what's to stop him from doing it again?
Now, did you hit him at all? Come on, tell me you hit him.
Matt.
Just so he doesn't do it again.
I don't think I touched him. Ah, Jesus, Dad.
So what are you going to do?
Take karate?
Oh, that is not the problem.
Mom, you know you like her.
I like a lot of people, Frank. What about the boys? Did they see it?
No, they were asleep.
Did you leave her alone with him?
He left first. She was yelling at him, and I believe she had a skillet in her hand.
For God's sakes. Did you call the police?
Not yet.
You didn't call them?
Well, he just got in. When I had a chance to call the police.
The
no, Mom, no, don't call them. If you call police, they'll come over and scare the kids.
Matt?
You gotta call them.
No, we're not calling them. It was a scuffle. That's it. It wasn't serious.
Oh, right. Just like the relationship isn't serious.
Sissy Spacek in the intimate heart of an impossible domestic situation in The Bedroom. Ghirardelli, there they are, the big five. How are you calling Best Actress?
I'm going with Sissy. I think that she's going to take it. I think it's a small film with a great actress being the one that walks away with the little statue under her arm.
All right, Ghirin. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about Best Actor. Thanks for joining us tonight. Ghirardelli is movie reviewer and critic, the owner of Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. We'd like to get your votes for Best Actor, Actress, Supporting Actors, Director, and Picture. Go to our website at onpointradio.org for a list of the nominations, then email your votes to onpoint@wbur.org. We'll let you know how your picks match our predictions at the end of the week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point.
This is WBUR.